inpatient education and bike helmet use, falling through the cracks during disasters, underuse of epinephrine, and we're going to take a look at the bowel disorder Crohn's disease. If that's what you're looking for on this week's show, well, you found it right here on the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MediCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the program this week. There's a great show coming up for you, including a look at some of the people who fell through the cracks during Hurricane Sandy a few months back. You know, that disaster affected so many people, and we saw the devastation, but do we really understand how some people are just teetering on the edge all the time of being without normal resources, even in the best of times? And when a disaster comes along, it just makes it completely so they can't cope with the problem. That's something that we are going to follow up on here on the show, and I hope you'll follow up and check on that as well, plus our other news items coming up. Then we're going to be looking at Crohn's disease. We don't talk about some of these other disorders and things that we might come across, patients with given problems and medical history that aren't really going to be treated in the emergency environment, but we should still have an understanding of what these disorders are and how they might be affecting the patient's other problems when they present to us with an emergency. So we're going to follow up and look at Crohn's disease later on in this episode. Before we get to that, I do want to remind you to follow up on all of the additional information you find in this episode over at the MedicCast blog. That's available at MedicCast.com/blog. You can find that information over there under the show notes link at the top of the page. Click that link. You'll find the most recent episode listed first, and you can scroll down and find all of the episodes. There's links to news items there, as well as links to each episode's tip of the week and additional resources. I try to provide 3 or 4 additional resource links to everything talked about on the show, so that even though I might cover something in short detail for 10, 15 minutes here on the show, you can follow up and spend as much time as you need to understand how to apply that to your scope of practice, or in some cases, how you can't apply some of that information to your scope of practice. So make sure you're following your own rules and guidelines and understanding the topic more fully using those additional resource links. If you want to get back in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I look forward to hearing from you, and I do respond back to every single email that comes in. You can send me questions about an episode, perhaps a comment you'd like to share, or perhaps you have a news link, or maybe there's a correction I need to make. Whatever the case may be, send those emails in, and I will get back to you, and I may share your email with the listeners and viewers here on the MedicCast. And I hope you will continue to contribute to the MedicCast community. That's it. We're going to have some more contact information later on in the show, but we should probably get on into this week's episode, and we'll head into the news coming right up. First up in this week's news items, a look at how we can become more actively involved in prevention. A recent study looking at bicycle helmet use among pediatric patients discovered that doing inpatient training with real information, with discussions and frank information on what can happen if you get a severe brain injury, what kind of injuries that turns into, in a healthcare setting, actually gives the prevention message a little more weight. And it was found that these students and pediatric patients in the inpatient setting that received this kind of education on bike helmet use were much more likely to use helmets when riding bikes. With the numbers being so low, looking at children that are of young age, they saw maybe 72.5% increase in helmet wearing among children involved. When you think about the numbers of children that don't wear bike helmets on a regular basis, anything we can do to increase those numbers will prevent many traumatic brain injuries in these individuals. And we should really be working hard to work in that prevention field. You know, a couple weeks ago, I talked on the show about using a patient to provide that frank discussion point about the severity of brain injury when not wearing a helmet from doing skateboarding activities. And here we are talking about similar types of education and a study that found that it had a significant effect on increasing the use of bicycle helmets. So all of these things are important. And when you sit there and think about prevention in your community, don't sit there and say, there's nothing I can do. There's always something you can do. There's information out there that you can utilize and put a program into place. Go to your supervisors, go to the people you work with, go to your local hospital. You know, they are actively involved in prevention in the community all the time. Your local health department has resources. Find a way to get out to the local schools. Find a way to take a program like this and make it work in your hospital. Perhaps there's a way that every time a pediatric patient comes into the ER, part of having them come in is including information on how they can make themselves safer when they have when they're out biking, wearing that helmet. That kind of information apparently holds more weight when they receive it in a healthcare setting. So perhaps giving them that information and providing access to it while they're waiting to be treated or just after they've been treating and waiting to be discharged in the emergency department can be a way to implement something like this in your community. And so I would think about something like this whenever you think about prevention, and don't say you can't be involved in prevention in your community. Just find a way to get it done. You know, while I was at EMS World Expo, the East Coast was getting hammered with Hurricane Sandy a few months back, and there were many things that came out of that, and lessons learned about preparedness, information and lessons learned about how we can be as prepared as we want to be, but ultimately we are not going to have any expectation of the type of devastation that nature can incur upon us. But there is a community that is around all of us at any given time that is at great risk all of the time for any kind of disaster that could befall your community. And that is the sick and the frail, the elderly, that are unable to care for themselves or are just barely hanging on under the best of circumstances, so that when there's any interruption of any kind of services, they just lose health very rapidly. And I would point out, you know, think about all the people in the apartment buildings without power, living on an upper floor, they have no elevator, they are wheelchair bound or unable to walk in a long distance at all. They are being cared for by a spouse or a family, another elderly family caregiver, and they are unable to provide for themselves until someone comes and provides for them. And we saw this with Hurricane Sandy when EMTs and paramedics from other areas came in and started going through these apartment buildings and interviewing door by door by door. They found countless numbers of individuals in these situations that had not been able to care for themselves, had been without insulin for an extended period of time, had not been able to go down 9 flights of stairs to go outside and tell someone they needed help. And so they were without any way to reach out to the outside world. This is something that you should be aware of in your community. You should start, if you don't have that list with your own emergency operations center, you should be making a mental list. When something happens, even a localized disaster like a stream flooding or something like that, you should have a mental list in your head of where are the at-risk people in my community. You know who they are. You transport them frequently, and you know who are those people that just aren't able to fend well for themselves. When a disaster hits your community, a tornado, a bad thunderstorm that causes trees and power outages, situations like a local stream rising, whatever the case may be, knowing where those individuals are and being proactive about getting to them can make a non-emergent situation be something you can manage rather than getting back to them days later and finding out that now it's become a severe emergency, a patient in cardiac arrest because they went into insulin shock, for instance. All of these things can be staved off by a little bit of preparedness on your part. So preparedness is not just an individual thing. Preparedness is not just something you do for you and your family to make sure you're ready to stave off a problem, but as a member of the emergency response community, preparedness is something you do to make sure you're taking care of those that are least able to care for themselves when disaster strikes. Finally, in the news this week, an article I picked up out of the College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology annual scientific meeting recently held in Anaheim, California. And this organization had recently had a study presented to them that found that EMS professionals were not as proactive as they should have been in dealing with anaphylaxis patients. Patients with severe allergic reactions and anaphylactic reactions were less likely than had previously been thought to receive epinephrine in the field. I wonder why that is. Are we afraid to give epi to patients? Are we unable to accurately assess a patient who has a severe allergic reaction and understand what it is we're looking at? Do we not understand how quickly a severe or moderate allergic reaction can progress to an anaphylactic reaction? This is something that we should probably do some education on, and I'm going to look on that as a future episode segment here on the show. But it's something for you to review. Get your protocols out. Get your educational materials out if you're a new paramedic, and review allergic reaction, review anaphylaxis, and review your protocols guidelines on using of epinephrine. How is it dosed? How can you give it? How often can you give it? All of these things should be something that you consider very carefully coming up. It's wintertime, and we're not going to see as many allergic reactions as we see, I think, in the summertime when people are out of doors and bee stings and things like that. But you are going to have them related to medications, related to incidental contact with peanuts and things like that. You should be prepared to manage patients effectively. And this study is a little bit alarming, quite honestly. They've looked at this, and I know that this has cropped up in my community in the past when people did not effectively recognize when they should be using something like an EpiPen for a BLS provider. This is something that, whatever your level in EMS, you should be comfortable recognizing allergic reaction and utilizing the tools to treat allergic reaction, such as epinephrine. Time for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to look at the inflammatory bowel disorder, Crohn's disease. Crohn's disease is one of those things you may see crop up in a patient history, and you just kind of write it down. But do you really understand what it is? Do you understand how it may affect your care of the patient in certain situations that may be more of an emergency-related situation? Patients with Crohn's disease are all around us, and many of them living relatively normal lives with management and medications. But when a disease or another problem presents itself, a motor vehicle accident, a traumatic injury, or something like that, how accurate are we in understanding how Crohn's disease might affect their current medical problem? So I think it's important to review these other types of healthcare problems periodically, even here on the MedicCast in the emergency care arena. So let's look at Crohn's disease. Welcome to this week's tip of the week, and we're going to be starting a series on inflammatory bowel disorders. And first up this week will be a look at Crohn's disease. There are two inflammatory bowel disorders, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. We're going to look at Crohn's disease first, and then we'll pick up with ulcerative colitis next week. So what are we going to be looking at? We'll look at, first off, what is Crohn's disease? We'll look at some of the risk factors and causes of this disease, or at least what is known about it. We'll also discuss some of the signs and symptoms commonly seen in patients, complications that may be presented with these patients. Sometimes there are some rather significant things going on with these patients. And then we'll look at some of the treatments and some special considerations to keep in mind when dealing with patients with Crohn's disease. So what is Crohn's disease? Well, it is a disease that causes inflammation somewhere in the GI tract, and it can be anywhere in the GI tract from top to bottom. It causes a rather deep inflammation, most often seen in the ileum, that's at the distal end of the small intestine, right where it meets the colon, the large intestine. It is but it can appear anywhere in the GI tract. And again, it's a deep inflammation. It's not superficial or ulcerative like the colitis we'll be talking about next time. But it is a deeper inflammation and causes significant swelling and prolonged damage to the gut. Chronic inflammation causing scar tissue, and it limits GI motility. So that scar tissue causes thickening of the walls, causes narrowing of the passageways, and that causes a reduction in GI motility. The body is not as able to process food through the system, and so things tend to get a little backed up, causing pain, and this slow-moving food causes the patient to cramp up and experience abdominal pain, and then also diarrhea, as the liquids are the first thing to be able to make it through the narrowed gaps. Liquids get out of the system very quickly, and you get diarrhea and sometimes some bleeding. I've got a picture here, if you're watching the video, that kind of shows the digestive tract and you know, some drawings of a normal and inflamed interior lining. The inflamed lining, again, swells to the point that it is very much narrowed. Half or more of the size is gone from the opening, the tube that is the digestive tract. So that narrowing of the opening means that just not as much food is going to be able to pass through and not as easily. And over time, as I said, this causes a scar tissue to form, which even more effective has more of an effect on motility, as the scar tissue does not respond as well to the smooth muscle movement of peristalsis, and it will slow down processing of food significantly. Some of the things that cause this can risk factors, you know, who can this occur in? Both males and females equally. Begins usually between the ages of 13 and 30 years of age, although it can occur at any time. It's most often seen in young adults into age 30 or so. So it's a young person's disease, but it is a chronic disorder. So once you get it, you got it. And so you have people that may have been living with this disease for some period of time. It's considered an autoimmune disorder. The body's own immune system is attacking itself. And it apparently the thought process is that the immune system in this situation is actually attacking the friendly fauna, the good bacteria in the GI tract. And it's this constant attack on bacteria the body is trying to keep alive that causes the prolonged inflammation of the lining at certain points in the GI tract. This can cause prolonged issues. But it is an autoimmune disorder, like arthritis, like lupus, so many other things, asthma and other related autoimmune disorders, where the body is having an unusual response to a perceived threat, and that unusual response causes it to attack itself. There is a hereditary or genetic component to this this disease process, and it seems that so if you have a relative that has had the disorder, or even a relative that's had ulcerative colitis or another autoimmune disorder, then you are more likely to have Crohn's disease than someone with no autoimmune history in their background. What are some of the signs and symptoms? We talked about some of them already, but obviously abdominal pain. In this case, because it's located in the ileum, often localized to the lower right quadrant where they're experiencing the pain. What else happens in the lower right quadrant? That's right, appendicitis. So this is one of those things that in male patients, you've got two things to think about. In female patients, you've got to worry about ectopic pregnancies, fallopian tube torsion, all kinds of things that are going on. And so this is just one of those things that occurs in that lower right quadrant, and it's a very busy area of the abdomen. But it's something to keep in mind. Again, remember, this can occur anywhere in the GI tract, though, so even up in the esophagus. So it is something that is most often localized there, but could be occurring in other places. Patient will complain of diarrhea, often complaining of rectal bleeding, and this may be profuse. It may be so bad, rectal bleeding, that the patient is going to require immediate surgical intervention to stop the bleeding if significant enough. Patient has got unintentional weight loss. You want to always ask that question to patients. Have you had sudden, recent, unintentional weight gain or weight loss? These are questions for the history of a patient that can be indicative of many different things, whether it's related to cardiac problems and fluid retention, or in this situation, a malnutrition related to a GI tract disorder. Patient will also have a fever. This is an infection. It's an inflammatory response. The body thinks that it's got an infection going on, so there will be often fever associated with this. The diagnosis starts with a physical assessment of the patient and history taking. We want to know what's been going on with the patient, what their symptoms have been. Have they, you know, maybe they don't have bleeding going on now, but they've noticed blood in their stools before, things like that. We're going to get blood work from these patients, CBC at the very least, and we're going to be looking for signs of anemia, again, from that blood loss, or we might be also checking for a white count on these patients. Again, signs of infection or increased white count will indicate that the patients are fighting some inflammatory response. We also want to look at a stool sample, and the patient will probably be referred for a colonoscopy or at least a CT scan and also an upper and lower GI. So these are all studies that are commonly ordered for patients with Crohn's disease to confirm the diagnosis once the history and the physical assessment and blood work have all kind of indicated it's going in that direction. You want to also check and see what complications could be going on with these patients. And this could be an indication of problems in other parts of the body or other parts of the abdomen or GI tract where this inflammation causes a stricture, a partial or complete blockage of the GI tract. Of course, a complete blockage means no food's getting through, or even a partial blockage can mean only liquids are getting through and no solid food. So we've got food backing up in the GI tract, and this can be significant and very dangerous for the patient as they may continue eating and putting more food in, but it's just not getting through. Fistulas can occur. Again, this is a deep tissue inflammation, so it actually can cause inflammation to affect the entire width of the lining of the small intestine or large intestine, and it can cause a fistula to occur. That's that tunneling from one part of the organ to another part of the organ. Remember, the intestines lie next to each other in folds, and you can have tunneling where actually the hole goes from one loop into the neighboring loop without going around the corner like it's supposed to. And that can cause infection, can cause food to begin to pass through there and also into the peritoneal space. Not a good thing. Long-term treatment also can lead to osteoporosis because so often these patients run through courses of corticosteroids, that can affect other aspects of their health, and that is related to a long-term complication of more likely to experience osteoporosis. And this is in men or women, so it's something to just be aware of as a long-term complication of this problem. And malnutrition, again, we're not getting food through the system effectively. We're not absorbing effectively, at least in part of the GI tract. And the diarrhea and the blood loss and the anemia all lead to a patient that's not getting adequate nutrition. And so that can be a complication as well. Treating this patient starts with medications. Again, I already talked a little bit about oral steroids, also immunosuppressive agents, kind of medications you might commonly see administered to patients with rheumatoid arthritis, with lupus, other autoimmune disorders that we're trying to suppress that immune response. Biological therapies like Humira or Enbrel have been tried to treat this, and they are also used to treat other autoimmune disorders. So it wouldn't be unusual to see them tried as a second stage. And then to treat symptoms and problems associated with the Crohn's disease, antibiotics may be administered to treat abdominal infection, and antidiarrheal medications, and supplemental fluids are very important in this patient. Again, they're likely to be anemic and they're likely to be dehydrated. So fluid is really important to keep fluids in this patient. And if you're a nurse and you're listening to this, you're going to want to make sure you're monitoring your eyes and nose for this patient if they're in the hospital. You want to know what they're taking in, what they're putting out, so you can see where they're losing fluid or not. For non-medical medication treatment, surgery is indicated in some cases. Again, when you have that constriction, that stricture that occurs, it may require resection of a portion of the bowel, a portion of the large intestine. And resection is removal of a section and putting it back together after you've removed the section with the stricture in it. So resection, it makes a whole lot of sense, right? You're going to re-put it back together there. You may also have a proctocolectomy. This is a removal of the colon as well as the rectum, or at least part of the rectum. And this is a very severe treatment, obviously, and it can lead to an ileostomy for this patient, which is basically an alternative outpoint for feces coming out of the GI tract, usually through the abdomen, and they would have to attach a colostomy bag to that and go through that process. And you may have patients that have already had that occur. And so you need to be sensitive to the fact that this is what they have going on. And if you're able to do so, you want to assess that ostomy for healthy pink tissue if you know how to do so. Nutritional support is always indicated for these patients. Are they eating well? Do they have someone that's helping them prepare foods if they live by themselves? These are all things that are important to keep track of with these patients. You want to make sure you're educating patients and families. If you know about this, if they're new to this disorder, direct them to ask questions of their primary care provider, or if you're a nurse, you can answer some of these questions yourself. Listen to what they say. This is really important because this is an autoimmune disorder. Sometimes the flare-ups are related to external factors. Stressors in the patient's life can be causing them to have increased problems at certain times, either of the week, of the day, whatever the case may be. And if you can figure out what those stressors are by listening to the patient, you may be able to help them identify that stressor and remove it or lessen the effect of it in their lives. Of course, if it's someone's spouse, that's not always easy, but maybe the education that this is what's causing some of the problem can allow for some of the stress to go away. Smoking and stress, as I've said, can worsen the inflammatory bowel disorders, smoking especially, and you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. What does nicotine do? What is one of the effects of smoking? It causes vasoconstriction. That vasoconstriction in an area that's already inflamed and probably doesn't have good blood flow just makes that inflammation worse. So we want to, patients that are smokers that have Crohn's disease probably need some assistance and some encouragement to stop smoking. Provide them access to support groups if necessary or direction. Even if you're an EMS listening to this, there are often regular support groups for smoking cessation in your local health department. Take a moment and ask the question the next time you're at the hospital when the next smoking cessation groups are meeting or where they meet, so you have that information kind of in your hip pocket and can pull it out when you need to for those patients that might need help stopping smoking, and Crohn's disease patients are certainly in that category. And then point them to reliable online resources. There's some excellent resources from the federal government, from the National Institutes of Health. They have a lot of resources about inflammatory bowel disorders, both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And I would urge you to follow up and have some of that information handy, especially if you're a nurse and patients have a lot of questions for you. Not always can the physician stay around and answer all those questions, although I think they should. But as a nurse, you can refer them to some high-quality resources, and you can start with the information available at places like the National Institutes of Health. And I'll have links to all of that in the show notes from where we got this information, some of the disease information I got from the CDC, and then the National Digestive Diseases Information Clearinghouse and the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases are all great resources from the National Institutes of Health for this disorder. Again, follow up in the show notes for this, and you can track all of that information, and I urge you to do so. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and urge you to follow up on all of the information available for you over at the MedicCast website. You'll find that at mediccast.com/blog. When you get over there, there's a link for show notes right at the top of the page. When you click that link, you can find all of the episodes going all the way back to episode one if you want to scroll down and go back far enough. There's information there on all the news items discussed in each episode, as well as all of the information and additional resources on each week's tip of the week. And it's your job to follow up on those additional resources. Look at your own protocols and make sure you understand how things I talk about here on the show apply or don't apply to your own scope of practice. So please make sure you follow up on that information. If you want to get back in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. Send emails in to me here, podmedic@mac.com. I want to hear from you, and I do respond back to every email that comes in, and I share some of those emails here on the show. So keep those emails coming with your comments, your suggestions, corrections, or information you'd like to share with the other members of the MedicCast community. If you want to follow up with me on social media sites, you can usually find me under the handle PodMedic. So twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic, things like that. And of course, don't be afraid to head on over to the MedicCast fan page and become a fan of the MedicCast on Facebook. That's at facebook.com/MedicCast. And when you get there, you'll actually find a like button at the top of the page, click that like button, and then there are additional articles, resources, videos, and other things I post over there that may not come out here on the weekly show, but you'll be able to find those resources over there on the MedicCast page. And one of the things you can do over on Facebook is comment, click the like button on an article, and if you're already a fan, that's a great way to share and expand the reach of the MedicCast community to other people you know. So don't be afraid to like something, don't be afraid to comment on something, and start a dialogue with some of the other members of the MedicCast community about a given article. I try to answer back whenever someone comments, and it's important for us to continue that discussion and maybe find a future interesting tip or article segment for a future MedicCast episode. I look forward to hearing from you over there. That's it. We'll go ahead and close out this episode of the MedicCast. I will remind you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back here every week on Monday with another MedicCast episode. And in the meantime, I want you to remember, Scene Safety and BSI.